Hot and Dry, Australia's Weird Winter, is a new report from the Climate Council. It examines the 2017 winter, Australia's hottest in history, and looks at the relationship to worsening climate change. To talk over the issues, I'm speaking to Professor Leslie Hughes from the Climate Council. Welcome, Leslie.
Oh, hi.
Australia's Weird Winter, a dramatic but well-deserved title given the records that were broken. Could you paint a picture of the winter just gone?
Well, it has been weird from the point of view that over 260 heat and low rainfall records were broken for individual towns and regions across Australia. It was the warmest winter on record, with average maximum temperatures nearly 2 degrees above average, and it was the driest winter over Australia since 2002, but the driest winter ever in some of the states.
How uniform were these results across the country?
Well, they were pretty uniform. There were records broken everywhere, though they were slightly different. There were also records broken in individual regions and towns, but we've really had a very dry and hot winter right across Australia.
Now, in terms of dealing with people who are perhaps climate deniers and all that, they say, oh, well, it's just a blip in the radar, things are basically normal, there's always cycles, etc. So how does this sit historically?
Well, the Bureau of Meteorology or its predecessors have been collecting climate data since 1910. So we've got more than 100 years of data to compare the recent winter to. So we're talking literally about hundreds of thousands of records, both collected recently and over the past 100 or so years. So we can look at very long-term trends. And we know, for example, that in the southeastern part of Australia, rainfall, despite being highly variable from year to year, has been suffering an ongoing decline. We now get on average 11% less rainfall in the southeastern parts of Australia, which is where many of our food bowl regions are, since just the mid-90s. We know in Australia that, yes, this has been a very weird winter in terms of heat records, but we are breaking heat records all of the time. So 2016 was the warmest year on record globally, which beat the previous record in 2015, which beat the previous record in 2015. We know that globally 16 of the 17 warmest years have been since the year 2000. So this is not natural variability. This is very strong directional change.
So when did that directional change take off, or did it, has it been on steady rise?
Well, it really started to be detectable in the climate record from about the 1950s. Before then, there wasn't much other than year-to-year variability. But since the 1950s, and more strongly every decade since then, you started to see this upward shift in temperature. So, for example, we now get twice the number of extreme hot days than we did in the 1960s.
With a changing climate, Australia being an island continent, how does climate change affect the surrounding sea and the surrounding environments, mm-hmm. and how does that sort of feed back into the climate we end up getting in terms of heat, in terms of rain, etc.?
Well, we're seeing huge changes in our oceans. So as far as the climate system is concerned, the extra heat energy that's in our system because of the extra greenhouse gases in the atmosphere absorbing that heat energy, about 90% of that energy is going into the oceans and about 10% is affecting the terrestrial climate. So our oceans are warming very rapidly. Parts of the ocean around Australia, particularly the bit between Australia and New Zealand, that southeastern part of the ocean, is warming more rapidly than most other parts of the world. And then in Queensland and in the reefs of the Western Australia, we are seeing the impacts of that warming very visibly, with consecutive catastrophic bleaching events on the Great Barrier Reef this year and last year. that together have resulted in an estimated more than 50% loss of coral cover just in the last 2 years. So our oceans are really changing. The oceans, of course, are also absorbing much of the extra CO2 that's going into the atmosphere, and that's changing the ocean chemistry. It's making it more acidic. In fact, our oceans are 30% more acidic than they were in pre-industrial times, and that's affecting all sorts of things like coral growth and the thicknesses of shells and all of those things. So our oceans, in some respects, are actually changing from an environmental perspective even more rapidly than the terrestrial environment.
So we've also got the situation where, say, like, for instance, southeast Australia gets its rainfall from moisture from the Southern Ocean, and that's sort of what shifted south. So all the rain that Victoria used to get is now going into Bass Strait.
That's right. Yes, and that's what's particularly concerning for our agriculture. Of course, the Murray-Darling Basin produces about 40% of our food production, as well as an even larger percentage of our exports from agricultural industries. We've particularly suffered a reduction in rainfall in winter and spring in those areas. And similarly, southwest of Western Australia, the wheat belt is also suffering considerable rainfall reduction. So these sorts of changes have really big implications for food security as well as the economy.
What now, after the situation of the winter just gone, what's the outlook for the Australian spring and summer?
Well, the main thing that people are worried about is the bushfire outlook. A hot and dry winter, of course, sets up conditions for summer that are very risky in terms of bushfires. So where I live in New South Wales, we've already had bushfires. We've had several days of total fire bans in Australia. This coming weekend, we're looking at the Bureau's predicting that there may be the first ever 40-degree day in September in New South Wales, somewhere this weekend. So all of those things are a pretty concerning outlook for bushfires. So across Australia, most of the states have an above-normal bushfire outlook for at least some regions.
So speaking of bushfire risk, I recall reading that someone was complaining about governments not doing enough load reduction for bushfires. Did the weather over winter impede, you know, work like load reduction?
Well, it probably did, though you'd want to talk to the emergency services who are experts in this. Certainly around Sydney there has been quite a lot of hazard reduction burning, and we've had whole weeks with really brown atmosphere due to the smoke, and that has all sorts of health implications for people. Look, hazard reduction burning can reduce local risk in some regions. It needs to be done very regularly to be very effective, and certainly on days of really catastrophic bushfire potential, such as we saw in the Black Saturday bushfires in 2009 in Victoria, it actually doesn't matter how much hazard reduction there's been. It's not going to stop a massive bushfire on a day like that. So while hazard reduction can help in those urban bushland interfaces, it's just doing more of it never reduces the risk completely. And it in itself has both impacts on health, it has impacts on biodiversity, and of course we have had some tragic circumstances where hazard reduction bushfires have gotten out of control and caused considerable damage. So it's certainly not the one and only adaptation towards this risk.
Did the Climate Council look at all at agricultural productivity over time and try to correlate with that with climate change?
Well, in this particular report, we do have a short section on agriculture that your listeners can go and have a look at. And we simply note the broad general risks to our agriculture of things like declining rainfall in the southeast. We have, however, in the past, I've co-authored a couple of other much more detailed reports. One's called Feeding a Hungry Nation, which is on the impacts of climate change on Australian agriculture and farming. And there's another one called On the Front Line, which is about the impact of climate change on rural communities. So there's a great deal more detail in both of those reports. They're all on the Climate Council website. They're able to be downloaded for free and they're copyright free. But those two reports have a lot more on the agricultural situation.
The report does also mention the impact on energy infrastructure. Could you run through that for me?
Well, Australia's energy infrastructure is, of course, ageing. And when you have ageing and older technology, it means it's also more susceptible to interruption during, for example, times of extreme heat or extreme high winds. So, you know, we saw in South Australia a few months back the extreme high winds toppling over transmission towers. We know that in hot weather directly reduces the effectiveness of electricity transmission on wires. So the hotter it is, the lower the efficiency of transmission. And generally our coal-fired power stations, many of them are over 40, some of them over 50 years old. And so they also have difficulties coping under extreme climatic conditions and also under extreme conditions of use. So when it gets very hot, of course, everybody in the country switches on their air conditioners. That puts a huge load on the system. And if the system is old, aging and inefficient, that's when we get blackouts.
The Climate Council has called for meaningful action to reduce Australia's emissions from fossil fuels, except that the federal government seems to be in a state of climate policy paralysis. Where are we going to head? Are we still going to be in a sort of stalemate, or are other players like state governments and industry itself going to lessen the weight of climate change?
Well, all of that is absolutely correct. In fact, we've had about a decade of energy policy paralysis in this country. I don't see really that in the life of this particular Turnbull government we're going to have any situation that's any more pleasing than that, in that there is a really divided coalition with some elements wanting to move towards a clean energy target and promote renewables and other elements trying to cling to the fossilised policies of the past. And I don't see that being resolved within the life of this government. We do have an opposition that has said they would be willing to participate in a bipartisan approach to renewables and to a clean energy target, but that offer has not been accepted by the current government. So I do see this current stalemate persisting until the next election. It is the case that Australian emissions continue to go up. They've been going up every quarter since March 2015. They did decline quite substantially when the carbon price was introduced, and as soon as the carbon price was repealed, they started to go up again. It was a very, very strong price signal there. Australia has committed to a 26 to 28% reduction of emissions relative to 2005 levels by 2030, which is their Paris Climate Agreement commitment. We are heading in the opposite direction. There is no way on the current trajectory we can meet those targets. But it is the case that, as you say, local governments and state governments are really stepping up where to fill the vacuum created by the lack of direction and leadership by the federal government. We're seeing all over Australia, local governments doing some fantastic things, and we've captured these achievements in another of the Climate Council reports on our new Cities Power Partnership program. So those listeners interested in local government action could have a look at that report. And we also see some of the states bringing in very strong emissions reduction targets. Queensland has a net zero emissions target. South Australia has been leading the country in renewables. Victoria, both Victoria and New South Wales have also got some pretty impressive targets. So the state governments are stepping up in many ways. Local governments are stepping up. We just have a vacuum at the federal level.